Good afternoon. It is 1:32 p.m., August 7, 2025. This is an informal hearing regarding Northern State Power, and the case number is PU-24-378, and the topic of it is deferred accounting for the Prairie Island Indian Community Settlement. And I'm Randy Christman, joined by Commissioners Sherry Haugen-Hoffert and Jill Kringstad.
That was a fun slip of the tongue.
12 years. I started with the F sound. Fedorchek. Caught myself.
Because I keep saying I've been called worse. It's fine.
So we have a quorum, although this isn't really a meeting where a quorum is required. I do not have any opening comments. Commissioner Haugen, offered to you.
This is my portfolio.
This is your Commissioner.
I do not have any opening comments.
Okay, I'll turn it over to you in a moment then for opening comments and to just lead on the case. But when you do, we'll have everyone go around and identify themselves into the microphone for our record. I do want to emphasize, though, that it is an informal hearing involving only undisputed information. If we wind up running into disputed information, we will have to stop this and reschedule a formal hearing. Commissioner Haugen-Hoffer?
I think before I do my opening comments, I'll have everyone go around and introduce themselves.
Brian Johnson, PSC staff.
Victor Shook, PSC staff.
Zev Simser, Dorsey and Whitney on behalf of Xcel Energy.
Pam Gorman-Prohaska, General Manager of Fleet Operations for Xcel Energy.
Alex Nesbitt, Regulatory Policy Specialist with Xcel out of our Fargo office.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm glad we're having this discussion because I have a lot of questions regarding this, how it came about, and to really be precise is how you guys reached a settlement agreement and now what role North Dakota consumers should actually play in this. So to recap, I know we've discussed this before, and we have a new commissioner, and I know Jill is very well up to speed on so many things and amazing that way, but I would like you to kind of recap for us what we've discussed in the past. I know we've talked about separating out the DOE payments, which we did, and to keep this separate, and that's been completed, which is very good, and no failures. Everything just went off. So thank you for your work on that. So with that recap, how you got to the settlement and information you want to share as you present it, there might be some questions that we have at that point in time. But I know that at some point I'm going to have a few questions for you. So I will turn it over to the company and let you present.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Commission and staff, for having us here today. I'll just have very brief opening remarks, and then I'll put it over to Pam, who will be able to give a bit more of the history background as far as how the settlement was reached, the benefits of that. And that's actually the main thing I'd like to point out is that in this case update that we provided on August 1st, in there we indicate the benefits that have already been borne out of this agreement is that coming up next week on August 14th, at the Minnesota PUC, the CON application, we're understanding that it should likely be approved. So this settlement agreement, it's already borne out great benefit for us. So that's the only remark that I'm going to provide. And with that, I will put it over to Pam. And we have a couple of slides that we've provided as well, just with pictures to provide some additional context and location of Prairie Island Indian Community in proximity to this facility. So with that, I'll pass it over to Pam.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioners, thanks for having us today. Again, I'm Pam Gorman. I am General Manager of Fleet Operations. I've worked at the company for 35 years, so I have a long, extensive history, most of that in our nuclear operations side, but also now most recently on the policy side. So I get a lot of opportunity to talk about our existing fleet as well as what it might look like in the future. And then another part of my job for most of these years, I've worked with the Prairie Island Indian community and really value and enhance that relationship. So I'll talk about that in a minute, but maybe just to ground us a little bit, I'm sure you're all familiar, but our nuclear fleet is sort of the cornerstone of our portfolio. We have three reactors at two sites, two at Prairie Island, one at Monticello. They have all been providing power for more than 50 years. So at Monticello, it's 671 megawatts, and at Prairie Island, each unit is 550 megawatts. And again, other than refueling, which we do about every 2 years for an approximate 30-day window, those plants are operating 24/7 and really providing that baseload that we need on our system. So very proud of that, and proud as we look to the future and extending them. We've also, at Monticello, we've already done the extensions. There's both a state process and a federal process. So we did the certificate of need for Monticello, got approval for that in 2023. And then we went through the federal licensing process and now have a license as of December of 2024 that allows it to operate until 2050. So now we're in the process of doing that at Prairie Island. I guess I'll speak maybe first to that relationship with the Prairie Island Indian community. As you see from the map, they are located adjacent to our nuclear plant. And I would say from early on, that relationship was challenged. We maybe were not the best communicators, and while I wasn't around when the plant was built, I know that there was not the best communication and maybe not the best interface with that community. So I can tell you firsthand that we worked really hard on that relationship to get it to the point that it is today. We work very cooperatively and constructively with them. We meet with them quarterly, have formal meetings, but I can tell you almost weekly I am having conversations with their staff just to make sure they understand what's going on at the plant. We want to not give them any surprises. If we have a diesel start that maybe isn't planned, we're going to give them a text or a call and let them know so they can reassure their community members. I think we've worked really hard at trying to be a good neighbor to the community that is closest to us. And although not the official host community, they definitely are the closest. So, again, spent a lot of time on that relationship. When it came time now to extend our nuclear plants, we knew that they would be an important stakeholder as part of the process going forward. So we began those conversations very, very early in the process. One of the first conversations is making sure if we could come to an agreement on their ability to constructively support the operation. And so very long time of discussions back and forth, and ultimately we did end up with that agreement. And I can tell you, as we developed the application for the certificate of need that Alex just referred to, we worked with them prior to even filing it. We wanted to get input on the front end, take their comments, take their concerns, and try to address them as proactively as we could before it got in the filing itself. But then the process, when we filed February of 2024, and like Alex said, we have the decision next week, over the last year and a half, we've had public hearings. We've had an administrative law judge assigned to the case. We've worked on an environmental impact statement, and Prairie Island Indian community provided some feedback on things that they wanted to see incorporated to that. And again, all reasonable things that we could work with them on to get to where the application is today. And as we said, we anticipate that we will get approval for that next week. And I can tell you that Prairie Island has been very helpful in us getting through that process and ultimately to the point that we are today. Our plan is once we have the state certificate of need, then we will go through the federal licensing process like we did at Monticello. So that would begin, we will likely file that in 2026. We're looking at second or third quarter, and then anticipate that would be another 18 to 24 month process on the federal relicensing. Again, our nuclear units provide about a third of our upper Midwest energy, so important to our system. And that's where we're at today. There's nothing else. I can probably shift it on to you.
Yeah, I think to follow on what Pam was saying, essentially, you know, after a long history of being an adjacent, you know, a neighbor to the Prairie Island and working with them and improving the relationship, it came to light that, you know, it was necessary to get them on board to go extend the life of the plant. And as you would with lots of large major stakeholders, especially when it comes to something as potentially challenging as extending the life of a nuclear power plant, you enter into negotiations to go establish, here are the rules of the road that we're going to move forward. Given the long history, given the fact that essentially the city of Red Wing annexed the land and was able to continue to, you know, continue to take significant revenues through property taxes. That's something was the Prairie Island Indian community was unable to do. We had been given prior payments to them, and it was time to sort of essentially renegotiate the deal. So in a cooperative fashion, in a cooperative manner, we just worked with them to work out what that agreement ultimately would be. And we worked out what we believe are fair and reasonable additional payments to them that are both contingent on, well, there are some payments contingent on, you know, the relicensing of the plant. So these are not necessarily 100% guaranteed ad infinitum. If something were to happen with the relicensing, we would no longer have to make those payments. Also, with respect to the fact that they are the most adjacent and very close to where the waste is stored, or where the spent fuel is stored, and also recognizing that the long-term spent fuel storage is potentially impactful to them. So at the end of the day, that was the deal that was cut. As Pam noted, we were very successful working with them cooperatively through the Certificate of Need proceeding. They were supportive. They were helpful, which is a requirement under the agreement that they work constructively with us to help us get the necessary licensing and certificates of need as well. So that's really what it is. It's the same sort of transaction that you might have with any material stakeholder who's going to host a very large plant for a very long time, especially given the uncertainty with long-term storage for spent fuel.
Isn't the DOE payments that we just completed, what, issued number 14? Isn't that, like, for the spent fuel, the risk, like the federal government didn't have an agreement and that's part of the agreement there?
Well, certainly it relates to the fact that the federal government was supposed to take the spent fuel and store it permanently,
right,
and they were unable to do so. Payments were being made by the utility to the federal government for that long-term spent fuel, and so the DOE payments is really in recognition of that broken agreement between all the utilities and the federal government. That monies get returned to our customers.
All of them.
All of them. And so, therefore, you know, we believe that the money paid into the federal government plus the settlement money should go back to our customers because it was originally as part of the rates they paid. So that's how we handle the DOE payments. They are both legally and from a policy perspective separate from this agreement with the Prairie Island Indian community. The only reason they came together is because when we were looking to defer or mitigate the beginning of these payments until we could file a rate case, that became a pool of money that was going to be offset. And so that's the only reason they came together. But from a policy and transactional perspective, they are very, very separate things.
And that's why we agreed to what we did,
exactly,
on keeping them separate. So, you know, this is the first time I've heard about a prior agreement with Prairie Island. Did you reach these agreements because you're mandated by Minnesota to have them on board or agree to something?
It's more complicated than that, Commissioner. There was legislation that did require payments to the Prairie Island Indian community. That legislation, those payments are not paid for by North Dakota customers because they were mandated by the legislature. The net incremental payments under this agreement were not mandated by the Minnesota legislature. This was NSP and the Prairie Island Indian community coming together to determine what a reasonable cooperative outcome would look like between the parties. So there is no mandate from the state that we have entered into this agreement.
So you entered into this agreement with them because they're good neighbors?
Well,
tell me why we need this agreement at that cost.
Absolutely. The Prairie Island Indian community is a very important voice in the long-term operation of the Prairie Island nuclear generating plant. And like Pam said, the relationship hasn't always been very constructive. And so if we were going to go and obtain a certificate of need, get NRC relicensing, we believed it was in our customer's best interest to ensure that we had a cooperative relationship with the Prairie Island Indian community prior to going through the permitting process, rather than having them become a challenge during those times.
And what happens if they would have challenged it?
Well, we won't know, but there's opportunities where we could have been mandated to make payments. We could have created a settlement. We'll never know. But it's just like any other kind of long-term permitting process. They could have tried to leverage a different outcome, or they could have fundamentally stood in the way of our ability to relicense the plant. And so those are the kinds of judgment calls that had to be made as the company was looking to relicense the Prairie Island generating plant.
And this current agreement that was signed goes on for how long?
Through the license for the payment, so through the relicensing 2050.
As long as the plant is operating.
Yep, as long as the plant is operating, and then as long as storage is there for the storage payments.
And the value of that agreement is how much per year?
Roughly $10 million.
$10 million.
I think we viewed it too. If you look at the payments that we've made to the city and county, substantial larger payments are going to the city and county, and we sort of viewed this as putting the tribe on par with a host community. Like I said, they're not designated a host community, but clearly they are located closer than any other community to our plant.
So, for example, the city of Red Wing annexed the area and are collecting the property taxes from hosting, from being the actual host community for the nuclear generating facility. And so they're obtaining very significant revenues from the company that goes through rates because it's property taxes. Part of this was to bring the Prairie Island payments into parity or closer parity with sort of those same risks and rewards from being a host community.
Can you give me some background on who gets to designate which is a host community?
I think that falls within, Zev, you probably can correct me, but falls within, you know, city limits. And as Zev has said, the city annexes property. So per designation, they are the host community.
Yeah, I mean, host community, it's not a defined term or a technical term. The reality is the host community is the community in which whatever facility is sitting, right?
Okay.
And they're the ones that essentially get the municipal taxing authority.
I see. Okay.
I do not understand that. Wouldn't you build this outside of city limits?
I believe we did.
And so if it's annexed into the city, then you built it in town.
I think what happened, and again, I'm not the history buff on this, but I think when we purchased the property, it was not within city limits. And this is, we're talking late 50s. And then I think, I don't have the exact year, but Red Wing made the decision to annex this property in, and evidently, the township allowed that. I'm not, I don't know the history, so I don't even want to speculate, but I do know it started that we bought it from a private landowner that was not within city limits, and later that was annexed, and we were annexed by the city to be within city limits.
And the residential areas that are in that area have been built after the plant was operating.
No, the community was there. The community existed the Prairie Island Indian community existed as it does today. We came in, bought this property, but the Indian community was there prior to the plant being located there.
And if you look at the map here, where exactly is the town of Red Wing? If this is all of Red Wing.
I think it's there.
Do we have this on the screen, Jason?
No, sorry.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think it's just that.
Yeah, I think it's right there.
Right where?
I think it's the portion in gray must be.
I thought that was the Prairie Island Indian community. I'm asking the town of Red Wing.
Yeah.
I believe if you can see here, the gray is where the populated areas are. Here's Red Wing down here. So, I think the point there, Commissioner, is like a lot of towns and cities You know, their borders are not static. They grow, they annex property, they work deals out with the township, usually having to do with things like taxation, parks, availability of growth. And so just like it would happen in any city anywhere, over time, that's what happened here.
So who was in the negotiations on this?
I was. I mean, it was led by our OPCO president and our legal, but I participated, again, because of that relationship that I have with the community as well.
But, I mean, was it the community and NSP, or
yes.
Has the utility commission or the legislature or the governor's office or anyone else been involved in this negotiations?
No, it was between the company and the Prairie Island Indian community, and specifically their tribal council and legal staff as well.
I was looking down yet before you started pointing. Where's Red Wing?
On the bottom
there.
See.
Oh, okay, I see it now. And so on this map that you handed out, the gray is the populated, like the housing area of the community?
Of the Prairie Island Indian community, yes.
And that was there in the 50s already?
Yes.
So you built this, I don't know what this distance would be, but like hundreds of feet from houses?
Again, I can't speak to the history of it all, but the community did exist. And again, the company at the time, I believe it was initially going to be a coal-burning facility, and then at some point it was changed to nuclear. I don't have all the history, but yes, I mean.
Because this looks like what I can guess from scale, because Prairie Island Indian community can only be about so big. So
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking we're talking hundreds of
hundreds
feet
of yards. I mean, it's about 600 yards is to the nearest neighbor.
Really? Oh, that's much further than I thought. So,
but as you can see, I mean, this portion here...
A quarter of a mile.
Yeah. This portion is like a... There's a helicopter pad there and a training center on that side of the road. But yes, their property and their homes are on the other side of that red line.
Are you done, Fred?
For now, yes.
Yeah. You said the negotiations were between XL and the tribal community.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a newspaper article, I think, the signing of this agreement, and it wasn't it held or had to do something with the Minnesota legislature, ceremonial and recognizing that?
Commissioner, it's a little more complicated than that. What the transaction itself, the deal, was between NSP and the Prairie Island Indian community. They were in the room. They came up with the terms. That was really a bilateral negotiation. Now, like I had noted at the beginning, there were some legislative payments that were already required, which we don't pass through to North Dakota customers. That statute had to be amended to capture so that there wasn't an overlap, there wasn't a problem. And in the agreement, the parties actually agreed to what those terms of that transaction of that legislation should be, how it should be amended, and they also agreed that they won't that the agreement can be terminated if the legislature expanded or narrowed that. So really what it was doing is it was codifying this transaction and ensuring that there was no other problem with the existing legislation. So it was necessary. I mean, this is a nuclear power plant, it's an Indian community, it's a complicated kind of transaction. But the parties agreed that this was what the legislative language should be to enact this particular agreement amongst them. And similarly, because of the way the prior legislation had been structured, there was also an agreement between NSP and the state government that the Prairie Island Indian Community was a third-party beneficiary. But that was, again, just coming off of the heels of the old legislation that had directed certain payments.
And now, due to this new agreement that has been reached, you're requesting North Dakota pay their share of this settlement.
Correct. Of the incremental additional. Correct.
And tell me why we should.
I mean, it's just like any other cost of operating. It's just like essentially the way we think of it is a bit of a property tax cost. It was part of the cost of the permitting and enabling it to happen, and it's part of the cost of being a good neighbor to our host communities. It's the same as whenever there's additional cost to extending the life or repowering or rebuilding a generating plant of any kind. So we think it's just an absolutely legitimate cost of operating the plant. I will note two things, Commissioner, I think it's worth pointing out. Number one, since we filed our petition for the deferral, we have filed a rate case. And so
Yes, you have.
Yes, we have. And so, you know, our request here is really just to capture the 2024 costs and defer them until the prudence of the payments themselves can be determined. They're in the rate case. We think there's going to be a long-term determination, or there should be, as part of the rate case. And so this is really, right now, we're just asking for a deferral, less of an approval to collect those costs for now or forever. And so I just want to note that since we filed, we now have that piece that I think is quite important. And I just don't want us to lose sight of the request that we're making in this case specifically.
Thanks for that clarification.
I don't think this would be trade secret, but remember,
we'll find out.
So you can tell me if. But if this were in effect, would the payments going to Prairie Island Indian Community versus the payments going to Red Wing, Minnesota, the various taxing districts there, the school, the city, whatever goes to the county, I don't know, park district, would the two be pretty comparable? Would one be twice as large as the other? Just roughly, how would they compare?
I know they were out of whack significantly before this agreement, but I don't know what they look like now.
I mean, I would say high level, the city county school district is probably double if you put them all together versus what is going to the Indian community.
Currently.
Yes. No, including this new agreement. This updated agreement. I mean, still, the local jurisdictions are getting still significantly more based on property taxes.
And so how would you say your workforce compares, like, percentage of their children that are going to school in Red Wing versus, I assume there's a school in the Prairie Island community? Percentage that are driving in from the north versus the south on the public roads. Are most of them from down in Prairie Island, up in Prairie Island, or down in Red Wing?
You know, I don't know the logistics. I mean, obviously they have a core group that lives at the community. There's certainly community members that live in Red Wing, but they also tend to live in the Twin Cities area. So I don't have it broke out by population exactly, but I can tell you it's not limited to Prairie Island or even to Red Wing. I would say, just thinking of the council and the people I know, they're more in the Woodbury, Twin Cities area versus Red Wing.
Were you talking about the nuclear workforce, Commissioner?
Yeah.
Oh, the nuclear workforce. Sorry.
I
thought you were talking about the Prairie Island Indian community. I didn't know. The workforce, I would say, is divided. I mean, we have probably 40%, same thing, probably 40% that are in Red Wing, and then maybe another 60 that are either in Wisconsin or the Twin Cities. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. this isn't so much on topic, but I'm just trying to, for my notes, to keep a concept of where you're at with your nuclear facilities in general. Can you give me the years when Monticello and Prairie Island came on board, and then remind me again when the new federal licensing agreement took effect for Monticello?
Yep. So we'll start with Monticello, initially licensed in 1970, currently licensed through 2030, because the initial license was a 40 year. So we went through the first relicensing, got it to 2030, and now we've done it's called license renewal. It's a second license renewal, subsequent license renewal. It's currently licensed through 2050 with our federal regulator. But again, we need the state certificate of need for the storage that goes with that. And at Monticello, we actually have storage through 2040. So we still have to either amend that or go back to the commission and get that last 10 years of storage that supports the operation to 2050. At Prairie Island, there's two units.
Just a minute. Yep. I did not know that the storage is not included in there.
Yeah, because the storage is a certificate of need through the state. The federal license is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
And so am I right then that, so you said the original license was through to 2010.
Yep.
And then you extended that to 2030.
Correct.
It's that extension when we got the turkey manure plant and the wood chip plant and all that stuff that we bought our way out of?
That's back on the Prairie Island. So Monticello is...
Oh, okay.
So when we move to Prairie Island, though, we can talk about that.
Okay, then I'm ready for Prairie Island.
Okay, so Prairie Island began operating in 73-74 because there's two units and they came online about a year apart. Originally licensed until 2013 and 2014. And then I'll talk about the federal side and then I'll move to the state to get to your question. The first license renewal then took us to 33 and 34, which is where the licenses are today at Prairie Island. And then what we will file with the NRC in 2026, we'll ask subsequent license renewal, we'll ask for that next 20 years, so to 2053 and 54. On the state side, we originally had to go to the legislature back in 1993 to get, we went through the commission and the legislature, and that's when we got some initial storage. And it was 17 casks, but then there were some additions like the biomass facilities and some of the wind and solar. Since that time, it's just a state certificate of need process. We no longer have to get legislative approval. They can weigh in. There's a legislative stay requirement, but the approval really comes via the commission. So we have the certificate of need process, for example, the one that we're in today, asking for 20 years of storage. So we're asking for storage from 2033 and 34 to 2053 and 54. And that's the certificate of need that is in with the state today, asking for permission for that storage.
And when you ask for that, are you asking for temporary storage or permanent storage?
We're asking for temporary storage at the site. As Zev has already alluded to, we know that the Department of Energy has a legal obligation to take that fuel. Now, they have not lived up to the timing that they have promised us and our customers and our stakeholders, but the intent is for the fuel to be stored there temporarily until either some type of federal facility is available, or it could be there are two private entities that have licenses, one in Texas, one in New Mexico, to store it on an interim level or interim state until a federal repository is ready. So it could be moved to either a DOE type of facility or a private if they begin operation.
But those are also not permanent. Those are temporary.
The one in Texas and New Mexico is an interim storage facility. DOE, you're right, is charged with determining and building the permanent repository.
Well, I think we'll be waiting a long, long time for that. I think I'm right that there is no permanent storage in America. So all of your storage is temporary.
Right, correct. I mean, the intent, again, is that DOE has legal responsibility to take title to it and move it to a permanent repository. I mean, I can tell you DOE is working on this It used to be called consent-based siting program. Now it's called the collaborative-based siting program, where they expect to issue an RFI yet in 2025, where they will be asking communities that may be interested in hosting both an interim, could be interim and permanent storage location, to come forward and get some grant money to start studying the feasibility of hosting that. And so the intent, the schedule shows that the RFI will come out later this year. I mean, I'll also tell you, recycling, a lot of conversations around recycling have entered the picture. There is technologies today that can take fuel from, you know, a Prairie Island or Monticello and recycle it in their reactors. And so a lot of conversation around recycling as well. Is it going to be permanent storage? Is it going to be recycling and reusing? And I think that's part of what, you know, at a federal level, we're trying to understand what's the best path for our country.
When is that RFI? You talked about going out.
The Department of Energy is expecting to issue that request for interest at the end of 2025. Was the timeline that I've most recent timeline I've heard about. They did a consent-based siting grant 2.5 years ago, where they gave out 13 grants to communities that wanted to further study and provide input to the Department of Energy on what a consent-based siting program can look like or could look like. And so now we're ending the period of those grants and now moving on to the next phase, which would be a request for interest, where communities actually say, we want to study this further. We may be interested in hosting the interim storage. And so, like I said, the latest schedule was end of 25. They would issue the RFI.
Would you describe interim storage as the same as temporary storage?
Yes. Sorry, I probably have used interim and temporary interchangeably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you're looking for spots, I can tell you, as I drive around North Dakota, I haven't heard of a lot of people clamoring to have a nuclear waste storage facility built by their houses.
How much of the payment to Prairie Island is based upon the number of casks stored on site?
It's $50,000 a year per cask.
Okay.
I thought maybe you knew that.
So if you get to 2053, 54, mm-hmm. and everything is shut down, and there's still no permanent storage of nuclear waste, we're still going to be paying them forever.
Well, until it remains inside.
Sure. So after we're actually getting use out of the facility, we would still have to pay for the facility because of that storage. And I don't know how many casks we would anticipate being on site by then.
I believe it's 99. It takes us through decommissioning.
Okay.
But I'd have to verify those numbers. 99 I'm pretty sure.
Casks?
Yeah. We have 55 loaded today. 64 takes us out to the end of this license. And then, again, I think it's another 14. Again, I think we end up with decommissioning, so that means our pool is empty, so you can decommission the buildings and the site. We're at right around 99,
okay.
Give or take.
So roughly by that point, I realize it's by that point, not today, $5 million a year.
I mean, if that's the math.
Well, I'm just saying $50,000 per cask.
Times 99.
Times
100. Yeah, 100, roughly.
Yes. But I mean, we're still having an obligation to store the fuel there as well. So it's not just the payments that are being made at that time.
Right. And do you know roughly how many there are there today?
Yeah, there's 55 today loaded.
Okay. So $2.5 million.
Yep.
Roughly.
Ryan, do you have any questions?
I think that's all I have.
Okay.
Are they filling more quickly? It seems like if you've only filled 55 since 1973, that you would probably need more than 99 to get you through 2054.
We're filling about a cask every year and a half or every 2 years. You can think of that. So, again, for another, I'm going to do the math here, another 25 years worth of operation, you're filling 12 per unit. And again, then you still have to empty the pool, too, which there's some assemblies in the pool. Okay. So that's why that first 50 years worth of operation, we were able to put the fuel in the pool. So that's where we're.
That makes sense. I wasn't thinking of that.
Yeah, and we're actually one of the utilities that have a unique experience. We had an agreement with GE at Monticello, so we ship fuel from Monticello down to Galena, Illinois, to a GE facility. So we still have title to some fuel in Galena in a pool that is Monticello fuel. So we did about 33 shipments in the 80s from Monticello down to Galena.
So we have to pay for that, or is that protected?
That we are only paying a security fee on for maintaining the pool, and that is reimbursed by the Department of Energy.
So what would you do if they said, nah, we're ending this, we're going to do something else, and come and get it?
Well, I guess we'd have to figure it out. They do have other utilities fuel there. It's an agreement. I mean, it's a legal agreement with them that they will continue to store it there. So, I guess the worst case, they would ship it back. But I don't think there's any intention of that because, again, we do have a legal agreement with them. We've agreed to pay for the security costs, which DOE reimburses us. And like I said, it's not just our fuel. It's a number of utilities that have fuel there. And that was just a unique agreement with a GE plant. Monticello is a GE plant, General Electric, and Prairie Island is Westinghouse. So we had a little different agreement with that fuel and used the energy, and then they took it back.
Yeah, I am too.
Victor and Brian, you're good? So did you have anything else, you know, besides fielding questions that you wanted to add in addition to what you did provide?
No, I mean, I think it's all here. Just as a reminder, really all we're asking for here is the deferral. And so to make sure that as we think about that, that it's a very limited ask.
Are there any objections to the evidence presented today becoming part of the record? And by the evidence, I'm talking about the recording as well as the handouts.
Nope.
None from staff.
Okay. Then the evidence will become part of the record upon which a decision will be made. Are there any other matters for the record? Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.